Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll spend some time talking about the European Union. This is an entity, 27 nations, 491 million people. It is in many senses both an economic and political institution, but something that I think probably a lot of people in the United States really don't quite understand. And so says our guest this morning, U of I Professor of Political Science Robert Parr. Well, maybe a lot of Europeans don't understand it either. And we thought we'd take a little opportunity to talk a little bit about the EU and what it is, what it's intended to do, how it functions, and some of the big issues that the EU is confronting and wrestling with. And questions, of course, as we talk, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments and questions. That they try to focus them on the topic, but people are certainly welcome to participate. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
I appreciate it. So you, in your work, you certainly, the European Union is a major interest for you. But I think that for people who are not in political science and don't follow European politics, for a lot of Americans, probably most Americans, I think they only have the vaguest notion of what the European Union really is about. They may have this idea that, well, yes, there was this idea that the countries wanted to break down trade barriers and make for a larger economic entity. And a number of these countries are now using a common currency. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, perhaps, we hear these stories about, well, the European Parliament and what they're doing or what they're not doing. But to me, it's something of a mystery, and I'm sure that a lot of people here in this country, it's also a mystery. Is it also a mystery to a lot of Europeans?
It is a mystery to a lot of Europeans. Most of them – well, it has a really convoluted political structure, and a lot of Europeans don't understand which of the several people you could call the president of the European Union is in fact the president of the European Union, because there's several. It has three capitals. I mean, it's just a complicated organization that does a lot of things behind closed doors and is not – obviously easy to understand if you're European either. And it doesn't get a lot of media coverage. Most of it, if you're French, you follow French politics. If you're German, you follow German politics and so on. Yeah, but you're right. It starts out as an economic union in the 1950s, and that was the core of what they were interested in doing in the beginning. And it's evolved to do more than that now.
Yeah. This, given, as you say, that it started out as an economic entity and still is, and I suppose some people might say that's the most important function. Is it in some sense also a political one? That is, does it stake out political territory? Does it have political positions?
Yeah, there's three pillars of the European Union, as they call it. The first one is the economic pillar, which is the free movement of goods, people, services, and capital. The second pillar is a common foreign and security policy, which tries to, as you suggest, stake out political positions. And it's that realm of activity that you read about when there's, you know, deployments of troops around the world, or peacekeeping, or at the time of the Iraq War, the states that were talking about coming to a common position, which they didn't in fact do in the Iraq War. And a third pillar, which they call justice and home affairs. We don't really use those words in the United States, but it's a mix of all sorts of controversial issues, whether it's police, immigration, asylum, common arrest warrants, and things like that. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about, without boring people completely, to talk a little bit about the structure. Mm-hmm. And roughly speaking, I guess we have there is something that's kind of like an executive branch, mm-hmm. and then there's something that is kind of like a legislative branch. And that has two parts. Let's just talk about the European Commission.
Okay.
This is the executive part. What does the commission and they have a president,
right?
Serves a term of 5 years,
right?
The current guy is up for reconsideration for another 5 years. Not everybody apparently is happy with the job he's done, but what is the function of the commission?
Well, the commission is the main executive body, but when you talk the EU, I would try not to think in terms of executive, legislative, judicial powers because it's complicated. So it's a little bit like our cabinet. These are people who are appointed, and in principle, they serve out an entire term. So it's not like the UK where Gordon Brown could be kicked out by his own party tomorrow if he got a vote of no confidence. Mm-hmm. So it's more like Secretary Gates. He's in for the length of his term unless he resigns. So they are in charge of the bureaucracies underneath them, or the eurocracies underneath them. And there's one of the commissioners from each country, so there's 27. There's lots of important commissions. So external trade, for example, has always been an important one. Economics and finance and other important things. But with 27, you can imagine that there's a number of not so important commissioners too, like information society or multilingualism, which are second tier. They carry out the laws like an executive does, but like a legislature, they also propose legislation. They have the sole right to propose a law to the other bodies of the EU. And in the area of what we call antitrust, they actually have some judicial or prosecution powers. So they have a little bit of judicial powers as well, which is one of the reasons why I wouldn't use those terms. But they're the main – they're supposed to represent the union as a whole and the interests of everyone in the country in Europe as a whole. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to serve your national interest when you're a commissioner. You're not supposed to take orders from back home.
And how do the commissioners get to be commissioners? Are they appointed?
Yeah, each country appoints a commissioner every 5 years. You appoint them to the commission, but you don't get to pick what job they get. So the president of the commission then takes these 27 people and starts pulling them out of a bowl and says, okay, you get this good job. This other person gets this other not-so-good job. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to encourage European countries to nominate good, talented people because otherwise they'll get lousy jobs. That's the idea.
All right. So we have the commission. Mm-hmm. There is a parliament, and this is something that we would sort of recognize as parliament. At least the members there of the parliament, they are elected by the people from the countries from which they come.
Right. They're elected by each country, and they're elected almost always in terms of the parties that that country has. So, Britain has a Labour Party and a Conservative Party. Germany has a Christian Socialist and a Social Democratic Party and a Green Party, and you'd use those labels when you're elected. They're elected for every 5 years. There was just an election last month. They just set up their new parliament. And it's called a parliament. One of the things that's confusing for Europeans is it actually behaves a lot more like the U.S. Congress. So it has parties, but they're not particularly strong. Everybody's loyalty is to their district. What we would think of as a district, but back home. And party discipline is real low. A lot of work is done in committees, which is unusual in Europe, but common in the European Parliament and normal for us, of course, where we do a lot of work in committees.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's fairly easy to understand that idea, the mm-hmm. idea of the Parliament and of the Commission. Now, there's a third group, the Council. And this apparently is – there are also, I guess, 27 members of this because there's a minister from every member state is a member of the council. What is the function of the council?
The council represents the nation states, and it's the most powerful body in the union. Who's on the council depends what you're talking about. If it's the Council of Foreign Affairs – then it's the foreign minister of each country. So it's the British foreign minister, the French foreign minister. Mm-hmm. If they're talking about the economic crisis, then it's the ECOFIN or the economics and finance ministers. So it'd be the Chancellor of the Exchequer from the UK, the finance minister from Germany and so forth. So who it is can change. And if it's a country like the UK where the government is Labour, single party, it's always a Labour member. If it's a coalition like Germany, where you have two parties in the coalition, the council of ministers could be a social democrat on some topics and a Christian socialist on other topics. And so the makeup, political makeup, mm-hmm. will vary even though they're representing nation states.
So every time that there's some sort of a different issue, they're talking about the makeup of the council changes?
It's different people. Right. Which it's hard to think of any analogies in systems that you're used to. But you know, imagine that we had a system of sending the governors to Washington, D.C. for regular consultations. Once upon a time, we did do that with the U.S. Senate. It was selected by the legislators. Mm-hmm. But imagine that that person was different depending on what issue you were talking about.
Now, here I guess I want to talk about the Lisbon Treaty. Now, this is something that has been proposed. The idea here, as I understand it, is it's supposed to streamline EU operations. And you can see here that it looks like they could use some streamlining, that this is a very cumbersome and complicated thing. But one of the things that apparently they want to address is the structure of the council and want to – right now, people take turns. Mm-hmm. Being the head of the council, they want to create a position that I guess would be kind of like the president of the commission. They want to have somebody who, in effect, would be the president of the council.
Right. So far, it's been a rotating chair. So for 6 months, the chair is held by a country. It was the Czech Republic until June 30th. It's now Sweden. And that means that in each of these different councils, if they're talking about agriculture, the Swedish agricultural minister holds the chair. If they're talking about foreign affairs, the Swedish foreign minister holds the chair. Mm-hmm. You can imagine if you have a six-month term, it's hard to get up to speed on all the issues. And if you're a smallish country like Sweden, it's hard to have the staff to do all the work of a chair. And so the idea is to have one person do it for 2.5 years with an option for renewal, which I suspect will not happen. And the trick would be how powerful or divisive would you want that person to be? I mean, imagine someone who's out of office like Tony Blair, who's controversial.
And apparently people are already lining up behind him and some others are saying, look, the position doesn't even exist yet. We really are kind of getting our head ahead of ourselves talking about what a great guy Tony Blair would be for this job. But people in England, at least, are talking about him as being the man who should have this job.
Right. But do you want somebody who's dynamic, mm-hmm. controversial? Would you want a Sarkozy from France who's also dynamic and mm-hmm. controversial? Or would you mm-hmm. like someone like Barroso who tends to be a quiet, consensus-based, backroom kind of fixer person? And I suspect they're going to want somebody more like that.
He's the guy who's the current commission
right.
president who is up apparently for a second term. And it sounds as if, just from what little I read about it, there are some people who that's their objection to his being coming into the position again, that they think, well, this guy actually hasn't been very effective.
Yeah, he certainly – there's nothing associated with his name. If you want the president of the commission to come up with bold initiatives – he's not your guy. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if he comes up with bold initiatives, the nation states would have to agree to them. And they're the ones who chose him. So apparently they don't want bold initiatives. They want somebody mm-hmm. who's not going to rock the boat or cause trouble or stir up things.
Well, it strikes me that if for example, they did this and they created this permanent council president, mm-hmm. that right there you'd have the natural possibility of conflict between the two presidents, between the commission president and the council president, or at least that there might be – would there be questions about who exactly is in charge here?
Well, you already have some of that. I mean, because there's a president of the commission, Barroso, who's in for a 5-year term. The president of the council, which rotates, when Sarkozy had the presidency a year ago, of course, Sarkozy is a colorful figure and Barroso is not, and so there was always tension between the two of them. The Czech, the holder of the Czech presidency, Topolánek, was also rather colorful in different ways. There are indiscreet pictures of him on the web when he was hanging out at Berlusconi's villa during his presidency, for example, whereas mm-hmm. the Swedish prime minister is a much less charismatic or divisive figure. So you can imagine different personalities would work with Barroso in different ways, mm-hmm. given his own personality.
What are there some other things about the Lisbon Treaty that are important and that might make for a smoother functioning of the EU?
Yeah, the most important is right now the legislative procedure of the EU has about 40 different procedures. So if you think back, you know, if you're a kid who watched the little song "How a Bill Becomes a Law" in the United States, which you can do in a couple of minutes on public television here, you'd have to have 40 little songs to explain those different procedures in the EU. They fall into about six groups, but even that's pretty complicated. The Lisbon Treaty would actually simplify that. So most of them would be a procedure that's simple enough to explain in a song like that. The bill starts in the Commission, it goes to the Council, goes to the Parliament, and then you settle disagreements between the Council and Parliament. So that would make life easier, and a number of other procedural changes would make life easier. It's still a very long treaty, and it's includes in it a lot of policy compromises that are being put into a constitution. So it's like the Illinois Constitution, which is a lot longer than the U.S. Constitution because it has things like guarantees for pension, public pensions that the U.S. Constitution doesn't have. Mm. So you have to imagine it still complicated like a state constitution. It's not nice and clean that you can teach a high school student in with the U.S. Constitution.
Now, for this to be adopted, all of the 27 countries have to approve it.
Yes.
And the Irish said no, so that sort of brought the whole thing to a grinding halt. There is, I think, now apparently in Ireland the feeling that if they had another vote, probably people would say yes. Mm-hmm. Is the thought that eventually, and there are some, I think there are three other countries maybe where they actually haven't held a vote yet, or there's some question about what would happen?
Well, only Ireland is holding a vote on the Lisbon Treaty. There had been a constitutional treaty which went up to a referendum in Spain and passed, and went to a referendum in Luxembourg and passed, went to a referendum in France and Netherlands and was rejected. Rather than rethink what they were doing, the folks in the EU said, okay, well, what we'll do is trim it down a little bit and pretend that we've done something new and call it the Lisbon Treaty, which is where we are. But it's essentially the same constitution France and the Netherlands rejected. But we'll do it in a legal form that doesn't require ratification campaigns, except in Ireland, as it turns out, the Irish constitution requires it. And as you said, the Irish said no. That was the wrong answer from the standpoint of Brussels, and so they've been asked to take the exam over until they can pass.
Well, assuming that they have another vote and the Irish say yes
in October, they will.
In October, right. Is there still some question about whether we can get everybody else in these other 26 countries on board?
Everybody else has done the political thing. So a lot of cases it had to go through the legislature. It varies by country what they have to do. But it also involves official signatures by whoever it is that is empowered to sign on behalf of the country. So Queen Elizabeth, for example, in the UK is the official signatory. She signed it. And then there's a depositing of instruments that has to take place. And the UK hasn't done that final depositing. Czech Republic has not. Czech Republic says they'll be the last ones to do it, and the Brits say they'll wait until the Irish referendum and then we'll deposit. But if Gordon Brown falls and the Tories take over in the UK, the Tories have said they won't do the final deposition. Although if Labour deposits it first, they won't undeposit it. So the timing will get tricky depending on what happens in British politics and in principle Czech politics too, although they're less likely to cause trouble.
Well, I guess that one question would be, well, setting aside the difficulty of getting everybody to agree to anything, would the kinds of things that have been proposed now, would that make for a smoother operation of the union?
Yeah, it's going to be smoother than it was. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be as smooth as it could be. Yeah. And they didn't sit down and actually try to rethink what they're doing. They just tried to fiddle at the margins and simplify existing procedures. It'll still be something that I have to take time to explain in classes because it's not obvious how it works and it'll still be complicated.
Well, that I suppose then the ultimate question it invites is how do they ever get anything done?
Maybe they don't want to get so many things done. It's a system with a lot of checks and balances. And like our founding fathers decided, you know, they wanted lots of checks and balances to make it harder to do things. The EU, it's hard to do things. And if you're a nation state who believes very much in the sovereignty of your country and the identity of France or the UK, Maybe you don't want a supranational authority that can do a lot of things. You want them to do the things you tell them to do. And it's still very much designed so that it's not easy to get a lot of things done. The exceptions would be in economic policy. It's not hard to get things done that make an economic union, that take down differences between the countries or that harmonize regulations. But other things are hard to do.
Well, it strikes me that the frequent complaint, it sounds from what I read, that the frequent complaint of Europeans about the European Union is that it's a talking shop and that's basically what people do and that it doesn't accomplish very much. At the same time, it sounds as if maybe some people are okay with that idea because they're really concerned about this balancing of trying to do things that really isn't going to be in the interest of all the countries and that we can all agree to. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, making sure that national sovereignty is protected and that every country, they have their own agenda politically and economically, and I'm sure that they're going to defend that.
Yeah, what it does, there's sort of three things that it does. One is rulemaking, and so that's most important in economics. So if you think of product safety standards or workplace regulations, and if you were to sit in the Parliament of Germany and just watch bills come through, about half of all those bills would actually be implementing EU rules. So in the area of rulemaking, it makes a big deal. It's a big deal. It makes a big difference. Another thing that governments do is spending. And the EU has only about 1% of the total or controls only about 1% of GDP. So in a continent where most governments spend half of the total GDP, the EU is trivial in terms of money. So things that cost money, education, healthcare, the EU has very little to do with that. So clearly the countries have decided it's okay if you make rules. Just don't spend any money. We want to spend money because that's politically important. Mm-hmm. And we'll accept the rules that you have. The third thing it does, which is less important, is try to coordinate. So in foreign policy, you see the times it breaks down. The Iraq War is a case when it broke down. But most of the stuff it does is coordinate policy in the UN or other international organizations. And the EU countries almost always vote the same way. And so when those institutions are important, IMF, World Bank, the fact that they're coordinating policy is important, and in other areas maybe it's just a talking shop. So there are things that it does. There's lots of things it doesn't do. If you think rules are important, it's important. If you think money's important, not so much.
Well, from a point of view of not somebody who's a European but somebody who studies this, then can you say that – there are some things that have come about because of the EU that actually are important and that people in those governments would all agree, yes, that was a good thing.
Yeah, creation of the single market. I mean, the breakdown of barriers for goods, especially technical barriers. So they've written 100,000 pages of regulations to try to make product rules the same across Europe. Most of those are deadly boring, but they're things we care about, like beer. So Germany used to have a rule that you could only sell beer if it followed the Bavarian beer purity law, which requires only four ingredients, water, barley, hops, and yeast. That means if you have a nice Belgian beer, because Belgians put strange things in there, cardamom, raspberry syrup, or other spices. You couldn't sell a Belgian beer in Germany. So harmonizing those regulations opened up the German beer market. French wine is similar. Harmonizing regulations opened up the French wine market, although they still tend not to buy non-French wines. The Italian pasta market got opened up. The Belgian chocolate market got opened up. These things that we care a lot about, national foods got opened up. And you can certainly say both these foods and goods in general, children's flame-proof pajamas, those rules are harmonized. And that's clearly made a big difference for the European economy. And it ultimately led, after about 20 years, to the creation of the euro, the single currency, which also has made a big difference. It makes it a lot easier to buy and sell goods across the nations of Europe. It makes it a lot easier for travelers. It makes it easier to compare prices. So you see that laundry soap is expensive in Finland for whatever reason. Sneak across the border for laundry soap if you live near the border, or whatever else.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Robert Parr. He's professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. Among his research interests, the European Union. And that's what we're talking about. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have some people here. We'll start in with our caller in Champaign. They're the first in line, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. I've heard that the European Parliament is one of the most powerful legislatures in the world, and I'd like the professor's perspective on that. And then I know that the new president of the European Parliament is Jerzy Buzek. I think he's the first to come from an Eastern European country, from Poland. What do we know about him? I'll hang up and listen online.
All right.
Well, it's the European Parliament is powerful in the sense it's like the United States Congress. It does a lot of work in committees. It does takes meaningful votes. A lot of European parliaments are not so powerful that way. The British House of Commons is expected to fall in line behind Gordon Brown. So it is powerful and important that way. And again, if you're interested in rules, it's really important. If you're interested in money, not so much. Jerzy Buzek of Poland is the new president. It's significant. He's from Poland, one of the new member countries. 20 years ago, he would have been living in a communist country and couldn't possibly have imagined being president of a democratically elected parliament. He's from the center right, so he's conservative in American lingo, but not all that conservative by American standards. The president of the European Parliament is not as politically powerful as the Speaker of the House in the U.S. or things, so the significance of that will be mixed.
All right. Tazewell County is next. This is line two. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Mm-hmm. I am delighted that you're having this conversation. I spend a fair amount of time in Europe, and I don't understand the EU, and nobody I talk to does either. So it's nice to have some sort of explanation for this. I realize it isn't the case now, but do you see this as a precursor down the road to political unity in Europe?
Well, it already has a form of political unity. I mean, they are doing things that governments do, right? One of the things that we do is pass rules about things.
Okay.
There's other ways that they're not – they don't have political union. So they just had European Parliament elections. Those elections were not on the basis of the EU as a whole. It's not like a presidential election in the United States. It's very much all politics is local. If you wanted to be a member of the parliament from Sweden, you had to campaign in Sweden. It wouldn't pay off to campaign in a European level. So it's not a political entity that way. Can I imagine it getting more like a political entity? Yeah, that's the story of the last 50 years, and I expect to be the story of the next several decades too. I think more and more people will realize the importance of the EU, and people will start to think and act politically across borders. That's already being tried and not working very well. There was an Irish person who tried to put together a cross-European party called Libertas, which only ended up getting one seat. He had hoped to get several percentage of seats, so a dozen or two. That hasn't worked yet, but the fact that people are trying it suggests that in the future somebody at some point is going to succeed and pull off a European party and start to create real European politics.
Okay. Thank you very much.
At the same time, though, you don't see a time when people now in the individual capitals, people are very concerned. Those governments are very concerned about maintaining their sovereignty,
right,
their power to make policy. They are not about to let Brussels tell them what to do mostly. It just seems that the idea of individual countries and individual governments maintaining their power, we're not going to get away from that.
Well, it depends on how long your time perspective is, right? I mean, we had 13 colonies in the Articles of Confederation, mm-hmm, who very much wanted to hold on to states' powers, and they end up discovering that that wasn't quite working and formed the Constitution. And people still had a lot of loyalty to states into the Civil War and beyond, and obviously, we hope Europe doesn't have a civil war to solve that issue. But lots of federations go through this kind of sovereignty. Canada's a federation. Newfoundland only joined in 1949. It was an independent country in World War II. Nations do give up sovereignty. The Swiss cantons gave up sovereignty and formed Switzerland, more or less. So we can imagine over the longer periods, Europe doing something similar, whether we're talking decades or centuries. I wouldn't bet on the short term. But in the longer term, one joke I make with my students is, in the Star Trek universe in the 23rd century, Earth is represented by the United Nations. that seems unlikely to me, but do we imagine Earth being represented by the European Union that has swallowed up Earth by the 23rd century? Yeah, maybe, right? So, can we imagine something like that going on? In the long, long term, maybe.
All right. Maybe. All right. To Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to say, in regard to the remark that some Europeans are skeptical of the Union because they think it's powerless, that's not totally true, because certainly those on the left in Europe are very concerned that the Union is basically a capitalist instrument which is controlled by the business and financial interests. There is also the criticism of many of the what they regard as the over-bureaucratization and undemocratic nature of the European Union, because the commissioners have far too much power in their mind, and they're not accountable to any electorate, and that the European Parliament does not have the kind of power vis-a-vis the commissioners that, let us say, a Congress in the United States would have vis-a-vis the electorate. One other interesting thing, I think, in regard to these last elections was the election of Daniel Cohn-Bendit from France. He had previously served as a member of the European Parliament from Germany. He's got dual nationality. And it's kind of interesting how people could, with dual nationality, just go back and forth the way he does and serve from different nationalities. That's all I have to say.
All right.
Yeah. Cohn-Bendit is an interesting case. As you notice, as you mentioned, he has served from two different countries. And there are a couple of other people who have done that. Rolf Dahrendorf, who recently died, had been a commissioner for Germany but a member of the European Parliament from the UK when he moved to England. So I suspect we'll see more people like that. In the first part of your question, you made the case that you find on the left wing of social democratic parties, or solidly in the middle of what Europeans would call left socialists or some green parties, European Union's controls rules, right? And a lot of those rules, say workplace rules or social security or whatever else, have been fought for by the social democratic parties or by the trade union movement. And if the European Union harmonizes those rules downwards, that means that the historic achievements of the Swedish Social Democratic Party are being harmonized away by an international government. So if you were a Swedish Social Democrat, of course you'd be bothered by that. The achievements of your party in Sweden are being harmonized away. And so a lot of times you'll find on the left people expressing exactly the concern that the caller expressed. And you see the similar thing on the right. Nationalists in particular, French Gaullists, for example, think in terms of the historic achievements of the French state and see that being merged into a larger union. And if we had a caller who thought of themselves as a French Gaullist, I think they'd express a similar kind of concern from that end of the political spectrum. European project tends to be a project of the center against what we would call liberals and conservatives. The Europeans have different names.
As the caller mentioned, there and we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that one part of the EU is there's this parliament that's elected. It's mm-hmm. elected by the folks back home, and that there were parliamentary elections in June. The turnout was record low, and this is, I think, something that indeed got some attention that Greens and also far right parties made gains, and I think that particularly as far as the far right was concerned, people were saying, well, does this tell you anything about the rightward drift in European politics, particularly around issues like immigration? Does that turnout tell you anything important about the way Europeans either feel about the EU or about politics in general?
Well, there's two headlines you can always write for a European Parliament election. You can write them in February before the elections in June. The first headline will be turnout reaches a record low because it's on a long-term downward trend. And the second is that Eurosceptics do surprisingly well. Okay. So people who don't like the EU can vote against the EU in a European Parliament elections. And that means – and in a way that they don't get to vote in national elections. You don't get to say, hey, I don't like the EU in a French election or a British election. So they turn out in the EP elections and they vote against the EU or they vote in favor of anti-EU parties. So those things are normal. The strange thing in this year's election is the other thing people like to do is vote against their national government. So it's sort of like a midterm election in the United States. Mm-hmm. Right? We know that the Democrats are going to do less well in 2010 than they did in 2008. Right? You can write that headline in advance. Yeah. And the European Parliament election is the same way. Voters always vote against the national government if they're frustrated with it. This year was unusual. They voted against center-left governments and they did not vote against center-right governments. So if you were Gordon Brown, Labor Party, you got creamed. You only came in third. And that was true of social democratic and labor governments around Europe. But if you were a center-right or conservative party in power like Sarkozy in French, you actually held on. So Sarkozy mm-hmm. did okay. Berlusconi did okay in Italy. So the center-right held on. And it's not entirely clear why that pattern should happen, especially in a time of economic crisis. Everyone expected the message of the left to be more popular, and it clearly wasn't. The far right got a lot of headlines because there were a number of far right parties that did well. The UK Independence Party in the UK, for example, is one, or anti-immigrant party led by Geert Wilders in the Netherlands that also did surprisingly well. But there are just as many far-right or anti-immigrant parties that did poorly. The one in Poland that had been very successful 5 years ago was wiped out. Le Pen, who's been very popular in France for many years, got no representation at all. So there's more a shuffling of the deck chairs on the far-right and not as much of a increase as the media had portrayed.
Huh. And overall, would you say that the thing that's on people's minds, and if they're going to be unhappy with their governments, it's the thing they're unhappy about has to do with how these governments have responded to the international financial crisis.
Yeah, that was clearly important. And the surprise was that European voters said they didn't mind the way that center-right governments were handling the crisis, and they didn't like the way center-left governments were handling the crisis.
And what is the big difference?
Well, that's part of the puzzle. It's not obvious. I mean, all the governments are taking similar mixes of things, right? You have a stimulus package. You try to pursue an expansionary monetary policy, you deal with a housing boom, you deal with a credit crunch. I mean, everyone is dealing with a different mix of the same issues, and everyone's doing it in broadly the same way. Some countries, different problems are bigger, right? Italy doesn't have the bank crisis of others. Ireland has a really big bank crisis and so on. But the policies that the different countries or the United States and Canada are pursuing are not wildly different. And so I assume political scientists who look at voting behavior are going to be puzzling around over this one for at least a year, trying to figure out, well, why this big pattern? Why is it that voters liked what was going on the right and didn't like what's going on the left when they usually don't like incumbents at all, either way?
Well, about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Robert Parr is our guest. He's professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. He's director of the European Union Center here at the U of I, and that is a special focus of his work, the European Union. Questions are welcome. We have somebody else here who's ready to go. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and the call is on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder, is there any possibility that the nation of Turkey would ever be included in the EU? And if not, why not?
Well, Turkish membership is a big deal. Turkey actually first became interested in joining the EU and applied for the EU before I was born. I won't tell you how long ago that was, but I do have gray hairs. And so this has been an issue for a long time. In terms of the economic union, Turkey's largely a member already. So they have an agreement with the EU to exchange goods back and forth. It's largely on the basis of free trade or common market. And in other areas, Turkey cooperates deeply. It's a member of NATO. So in the common foreign and security policy, it's active in the same way that the United States and Canada are. Now, becoming a member is tricky. Turkey's big. Any reasonable time it becomes a member, it will have more people than Germany. So it would be the largest or the most populous country in the Union. It's relatively poor. It's not any poorer than Romania and Bulgaria, but it is about as the same income as Romania and Bulgaria. And it has a very large agricultural sector, and the EU has very large agricultural subsidies, so it would be a very expensive country. Those would be issues just in strict public policy terms, no matter what you did. The fact that they're Muslim raises cultural issues too. Officially, the EU doesn't have any cultural requirements. Its motto is union and diversity. So in principle, there's no reason why it couldn't include a Muslim country. And in fact, it has Muslims living in France. It has Muslims living in Germany, Muslims living in the UK. Doesn't have a majority Muslim country yet, but Bosnia is an imaginable candidate. Albania is an imaginable candidate. And of course, Turkey is officially a candidate. Turkey raises cultural issues that people feel emotional about, and lots of people feel emotional about their identity. In some ways, surprising in Europe because religious belief is much weaker there than in the United States. Church attendance is much weaker, and yet on the question of Turkey, all of a sudden they feel very strongly about their Christian heritage. I can imagine Turkey being a member, but it's certainly not going to happen in the next 10 years.
Who is leading the opposition to Turkey's membership? Are there any particular individuals? And if so, what are their motives?
Sarkozy in France has been very active in opposing Turkish membership. I think that's mostly for domestic political consumption. People who don't like Muslim immigrants in France like his stance against Turkey as well. The other big leader is Austria, and this is true across the Austrian political spectrum. Some of that's because Austrians are taught in school the history of the Habsburg Empire as a bulwark against Turkish or Ottoman invasions. And you know, big heroic dates for the Austrians are the first siege of Vienna in 1526 and the second siege of Vienna in 1683 when they fought off the Turks. And so they still think of themselves as fighting off the Turks many centuries later. We don't really have that kind of historical memory in the United States, but it's kept alive in Austria with the way they teach their kids. And there's various other countries that have similar views. The UK tends to be very pro-Turkey. The other countries along the periphery outside, you know, Scandinavia tends to be more pro-Turkey and so forth.
It would seem that the further you are from Turkey, the less opposition you have.
Yeah, yes and no. France is a long way from Turkey. And once upon a time, France was thought of as an ally of the Ottoman Empire, right? And these are countries with historical memories. And it's not true that the countries of Eastern Europe are anti-Turkish. And some of them, Austria is. But if you just went around Eastern Europe, you'd get a mix of answers on how the people feel about Turkey.
All right?
Yes, that's okay. An excellent answer.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We're coming down to about 5 minutes left. Turkey is... they're on track to membership, but I suppose there's no guarantee that it's going to happen and who knows when. The Balkans are apparently also on the track. I think they're a little bit further behind where Turkey is. Is that perhaps somehow more likely, do you think, that they would actually become members?
Yeah, until recently we would have said that Croatia was going to be a member very soon. And Slovenia recently discovered a border dispute with Croatia. And it's the policy of the EU not to admit countries unless they resolve their border disputes with other members before coming in. The EU broke that rule when they let Cyprus in because Cyprus has a conflict with Turkey and with Greece, well, depending on which side of Cyprus you're looking at. Mm-hmm. But the one with Croatia will be an obstacle until Croatia and Slovenia resolve this particular border dispute that dates back to Yugoslavia. Other than that, Croatia shouldn't be a problem. And Macedonia is also well along. It's officially negotiating membership. It has the problem of the wrong name. The Greeks object to the name of Macedonia because Macedonia is the name that belongs to Alexander the Great, and Alexander the Great was Greek. Mm-hmm. And there are Greek-speaking Macedonians in Greece, and Greece does not approve of the name of Macedonia. So international organizations use the name former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, or FYROM, as its working title right now. But until Macedonia and Greece can agree how they're going to use that name, Macedonia can't join. If they come up with a solution, Macedonia could join very quickly as well.
Mm. Just we're coming down to the last couple of minutes here. One thing that I think is kind of interesting is apparently that the EU and South Korea have just recently negotiated a free trade agreement. And mm-hmm. this is the first agreement between the EU and any major Asian country,
right,
which puts the EU actually ahead of the United States. The Koreans would like to have a similar agreement with the United States. This has not been worked out yet. I'm interested in the experience of the EU in working with major states outside of Europe.
Right. Traditionally, they've been active with other rich countries, especially in the North Atlantic area, or they've had deals of various kinds with their former colonies. South Korea is interesting and doubly interesting. The United States and South Korea do have an agreement, but neither our Senate and their legislature hasn't ratified mm-hmm. it yet. It's actually been controversial in both places. Mm-hmm. Both sides are convinced that they got the raw end of the deal. And the Europeans moved in and signed a deal of their own, and we'll see if they're any more successful. The U.S. one led to riots in South Korea, and I haven't seen riots in South Korea over the European one. But the potential is there. It's a similar kind of size market to the United States and similar kinds of trade issues on both sides. So we'll see if it ends up being finalized.
Yeah. Do the Europeans have their eyes on any place else? India, Brazil, any place in Latin America, any place in Africa?
Well, they have long-standing relations with their former colonies. So in Africa, you have France with French colonies, Britain and British colonies, and so on, with strong ties. Other than that, they have their eyes on everywhere, the same places we do. Brazil and Argentina are major soybean producers and want to be able to export soybeans. We're a competitor, of course, because we're a soybean exporter too. The Europeans mm-hmm. import and see an opportunity to get better deals or have a more constructive trade relation with the South American countries than they do with the United States and so forth.
Other, I understand that, is it Iceland?
Mm-hmm.
Looks like it's going to enter into talks about right. about joining. Are there other places? We talked about the sort of long-running conflict and controversy about Turkey, about the possibility of the Balkans. Are there other places, other countries where they would really like to be a member?
Well, Norway has reached an agreement to join twice, and both times it was rejected in a referendum about 20 years apart. And so Norway will be up for another one in 5 or 7 years, and I'm not sure how that will go. Switzerland is not a member of the EU. It is a member of various agreements with the EU, so you have trade and actually free movement of people back and forth, so you don't have to show a passport at the Swiss border anymore. Iceland has been another one that's been out temporarily been out for a while. Iceland would like very much to join for reasons of monetary policy and like very much to stay out for reasons of fishing policy. And so we'll see how those tensions play out. The center-right of Icelandic politics has traditionally been very close to the fishing sector. Mm-hmm. And they're currently out of government. If they were to win an election, come back in, the negotiations would stop instantly.
Seems that that's here really the big thing always has been balancing the interests of the many with the interests of the one. You know, that is how it is if you're a country and you're going to be part of this, how it is that you get whatever benefits of membership there are. But at the same time, clearly at home, you've got your own issues. And I'm sure they're different from one country to the next. But so you don't want them to get stepped on. This must be really difficult to manage to do that balancing. And when you have 27 different countries.
Yeah. And well, the rule in the EU is that you have to accept all the existing treaties. right? So in the case of Iceland, the EU has a fisheries policy, and the rule is that Iceland has to accept the fisheries policy as it stands. Now, the European fishing policy is actually a disaster. They have destroyed all their fishing stocks through overfishing, and Icelandic fishing policy is very successful. So Iceland, understandably, doesn't want to enter an unsuccessful policy for one of its two major economic sectors, the other one being energy, formerly banking also, but that's died. So Iceland would be destroying a big part of its economy. Occasionally, countries get permanent exceptions. Malta has a permanent exception in the real estate market. They do not have to allow Brits to move in and buy vacation homes and sink the entire island of Malta under the weight of retiring Brits. So there is a precedent for small countries to get a permanent break, but it's very unusual.
We are at the point that we're going to have to finish. I want to say thanks very much for spending tonight with us, Bob Parr. He's a director of the European Union Center here at the University of Illinois and also professor of political science.
Great. Thanks for having me on board.